Did you ever think you would make it? I feel I'm so close, I could taste sweet victory. I know this life meant for me. Yeah, why would you bet on Goliath when we got Bet David? Value taming, giving values contagious. This world of entrepreneurs, we get no value to haters. Now they run, homie, look what I become. I'm the one.
Third on all strikeouts, all-time strikeout leader. First pitcher ever to start a season in 2001 with 20-1. No one's ever done that before. MVP, 5 strikeout titles, 354 wins. I can give you a bunch of different stats on what he's done. One time, he pitched Game 4 of the 2000 ALCS game, and then right afterwards, Game 2 of the World Series, logging in 17 shutout innings and let only 3 hits in those 17 innings with 24 strikeouts. And an expert when it comes on to movies, give it up to Roger Clemens. How you doing, man?
Doing good, guys. I need you as my agent. Let's go. I didn't know some of those right there. That's
but
pretty good.
Let's be clear. Roger is more than just a baseball player.
Yes. Okay. So we had with you, Antonio Brown wanted us to make sure that the audience knew you're not from Liberty City. You're more than a baseball player. You,
family
you
man.
Have a family. Your kids, is it 3 out of 4? Is it...
All four boys start with the letter K. It started with Kobe. I punched out 20 in 86, and he was on his way to be born. And so instead of with a C, we threw the K in there, and we kept trying for a girl, but the K's kept coming. So
career, the K's kept coming.
Yeah, just it's like that.
Four boys all start with K.
Four boys.
But let me get it. Kobe, Cody, Corey, and Casey.
Man, that's pretty good. It's a tongue twister, but that's pretty good.
If you guys were going to have a girl, did you know what the name was going to be with the K?
Carissa.
Carissa.
Yeah.
I like that.
Almost adopted a gal, a little one. Man, she was tugging at my heart. We were at a deal, an outing, where some kids were getting placed with different homes, and it was close. I mean, it was pulling at my heartstrings for sure.
Roger, out of your four boys, how many made it into the major leagues? I know we just talked about 3 of them.
Yeah, 3 of the 4 all played professionally. Number 2 actually graduated from Cordon Bleu. He's a chef and in real estate. Hmm. And he played a little football, had his kneecaps reset. So I said, can we try something different, you know? And I always played the dad role. I tell everybody that until – you know, Casey, my number 3 child, Casey, just retired from the Blue Jays, and he was a big reason why I got hooked up to come down and get to do this with you guys. And the youngest one, Cody, is a second baseman, can play multiple positions. He's with the Philadelphia Phillies, just was traded this offseason from the Detroit Tigers. So, but I love it that they play, the game that we all love. And it's life lessons, teaching them to get along. But like I told them, I'm glad that they were all Americans at the University of Texas. I'm more proud that they graduated from McCombs Business School. And a quick shout out when I say that, Red McCombs just passed away not too long ago. Red was a pillar around Austin at the University of Texas.
And Red McCombs. Huh?
And yeah. It's a very, very respected school. My wife and I, we lived in Plano for 5 years, and my wife's from Houston. We met in L.A., but we lived in Dallas for 5 years. And, when you mentioned that school, salute, respect at the highest level. May he rest in peace.
Red McCombs also the owner of the Minnesota Vikings?
That is a great question. You pull that up.
Is it the same Red McCombs I'm thinking of?
Type in Vikings to see if that comes up.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, he was. Oh,
yeah. Good for you.
Yeah, I've heard that name for years because my family's from Minnesota. Yeah.
Good call right there.
Hey.
But you know what's one of the things I saw which was kind of cool? Can you pull up the clip? I think it's Cody pitching.
Oh, yeah.
And, you guys. And did you see that one right there? He's pitching. If you see this one here, which is sick, he's pitching against Shohei Ohtani. And watch what happens here. It's a really neat thing to see. Watch this.
To the story that I just learned, Cody Clemens, who struck out Shohei Ohtani last night, apparently
look how giddy he is right there.
Sign from Shohei Ohtani. He's like, time, let me throw in the ball. I want to get it authenticated. So here we go. There's an authenticator on the side.
It's like, what am I doing?
What am I doing?
It's like authenticated. He struck out Shohei Ohtani. And then Shohei Ohtani would sign the baseball. Even up.
How sick is that? When you see that, what do you think about it? Like, did he call you afterwards? Dad, you won't believe it. What was the reaction like?
Yeah, so there's a lot of moving parts to this and the video. First of all, he's throwing about 65 miles an hour, and it's called an air cutter. When we play catch in the gym at home, he was messing around with it. And you grab the ball without any seams. And if you throw it the right speed, it almost acts like a tight slider. And so he threw it back door on him. And well, first of all, he pitched in high school. He's pretty good in high school. And I told his manager at the time, AJ Hinch, that don't tell him or he'll have you out there. So anytime he's pitching, you know, it's not a good thing. That means the team's getting blown out. So
what's his position?
Second base.
Gotcha. Yeah, so he's not even a pitcher.
He doesn't pitch. He can play a little first, a little third for matchup problems, even left field. But anyway, so he's in a blowout, which happened way too many times with the Tigers last year. And he threw the air cutter. It came back over the corner. He strikes him out, and he reacted. And that's when he called me. He goes, man, I didn't even know I pumped my fist out. I was fired up. I said, no, that's great. I said, you know, that's what makes it fun for everybody to watch, and it's really cool for you to do it. Dad never struck this guy out, you know, so that, you know. And then he had the mindset to call time and throw the ball out of play. And then he asked me, hey, you think I send this guy will sign this? He goes, I said, absolutely, send it over. I knew a few of the Angel players. And but, yeah, that was the scenario. You know, and, again, you know it's a bad thing when it was the highlight of the Tigers season.
By the way, what do you think about him as a hitter, as a player, pitcher and hitter?
Yeah, you know, guys, I play the dad role again. The boys always tease me when I start getting into hitting the philosophy or whatever. And if they ask me a question, they're just like, Pops, what do you know about hitting? You were just a great bunter. That's all you could do. You know, I kind of just unless they ask me a pointed question, same thing with their teammates, their veteran teammates, I'll give them an answer. You'll see me at games. I'm kind of locked in on what's going on because I'm trying to watch the pitcher's tendencies. I really focus on the catcher too, because now with this pitch clock, the catcher's really going to be the quarterback, if you will, and the catcher in the major league is second manager anyway. And so I'm watching tendencies. You know, he might get a home run or something like that, and I don't even forget the clap, and the camera will be on me, and they're like, oh, you know, he's locked in or whatever. But yeah, when I'm there, I'm just watching everything that's going on. I was like that. I obviously was a student of the game when I was 21 years old, coming out of University of Texas. And just the other day, I told the guys, I back in the early 80s, I kept my hitters on 3x5 index cards. Then it went to my BlackBerry. Then it went to my iPhone, to the point where I tell my pitching coach in our meetings before the playoffs or a World Series game, we're going over hitters. I'm over there. I'm not texting my friends to come to the game. I'm actually logging stuff that I know. I also kept a book on the umpires. You know, I wanted to know that when an umpire was at this game that, it might be a home game for him, and he's left 8 tickets. He wants to look good.
Mm.
And, he might come out to the mound, and it was Durwood, whoever, and say, hey, how's Jennifer doing? You know, how's the family? And thanks, Rock, for asking. He runs back down. You might get that, you know, that borderline call. And it brings a personal element into it. But
on each player, the umpire, coaches. Like, you're just constantly keeping notes.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm looking at what I'm doing, and then obviously on a game day when you're going out there to see how you feel. I might not have 98 miles an hour that day. My shoulder, I might be a little underwater, as they say, but I was a power pitcher. I wasn't a thrower. I don't throw. I pitch, and I was afforded the luxury, obviously, being in Texas, getting to know Nolan Ryan and watch Nolan, never teammates. But for, I think, 3 months in Boston during a playoff run, we signed Tom Seaver. Mm. And Seaver's the ultimate power pitcher. Mm. I mean, I'm watching a guy, you know, I pitched till I was 45, but at that time I was probably 23 years of age in Boston, and I'm watching a 40-plus-year-old man out there. I can hear him grunting in the third, fourth inning, and he's sitting at about 90 miles an hour, and I'm like, okay. And then he got second and third, and the game was on the line. Boom. He popped one in there about 94 for a strikeout. I was like, okay. He's got a little left in the tank here. So it was great. And even watching him was one thing, but having the opportunity to just sit and keep my mouth shut and learn from, you know, just hear what he had to say. Did a radio show way back when with Don Drysdale. I mean, we can go on, guys. I mean, it's I appreciate the guys that played before me because they helped me make the living that I was able to make. I'm going to see one of my favorites here in a couple hours when I leave you guys, Reggie Jackson. I'm going to be with Reggie.
Mr. October.
I'm going to be with him this afternoon. And he, I tell the story famously that he was the guy I wanted to face. I wanted to get to big league as fast as I could. I think I pitched 12 games in the minors. And then my second or third start in the majors, I got to face Reggie. And he was a California Angel. It was a blast. I mean, you know, I almost couldn't make eye contact. You know, I couldn't make eye contact with him when he came to the plate. And, yeah, I mean, it was fun facing him and just the guys that over 24 years I was able to face.
Growing up, who was your guy? When you talked about Don Drysdale, Nolan Ryan.
Yeah, probably Nolan and Seaver were the guys. Reggie was one for sure. You know, but I faced the Don Baylors, Dave Kingmans, Luzinski, the Bull, you know, all these guys all the way through the Albert Pujolses, you know. I think Albert called me, I know Kirby Puckett called me Heat, I think Albert called, but he'd say, you know, Heat would always give me one good pitch to hit, and if I missed it or fouled it off, I got you. But those are good battles. I mean, you know, I talked about in the clubhouse the other day to the players, you know, I faced a Cal Ripken probably. Even though Cal was my shortstop in multiple All-Star games, I faced Cal Ripken, you know, say 120 times. So when the game's on the line at 60 feet 6 inches, he's got like 8 different batting stances, you know, where he holds his bat, he's playing the piano or playing the flute or whatever they call it he's doing. He's seen everything I can throw at him, including the kitchen sink, you know. So it's really a game within a game of how I'm going to try and get him out and do things like that. So I try and tell the younger players about that. It's changed a little bit. We got the pitch clock, strike zone. Now they pinch you east and west. You get north and south a little better, which I would like because I like featuring the ball high in the zone and then throwing my split finger down to jog your eye level. You know, just great questions from a lot of the pitchers. So
this new pitch count or this how long it takes to throw pitch a pitch.
Clock, yeah.
Pitch clock, sorry about that. So this pitch clock, is this the first season they're implementing that?
Yes, the minor league guys have experienced it, but yeah.
So I kind of want to process that, like where you're at with this thing, because, you know, baseball, you know, America's pastime, the legacy of baseball, pastime, using that word intentionally. These days, the biggest sport in America is football. Basketball kind of has the biggest icons, if you will, LeBron, yeah. Steph, Giannis. You know, baseball is all about tradition. You know, growing up, I was all about baseball. That was all I was at, you know, honoring the legacy, the past, Babe Ruth, Mickey Mantle, everything, yeah. Ty Cobb. How much do you think this pitch clock is going to change the game and not honor the pastime that was baseball?
Yeah, there's a lot to it. I mean, even when you talk about the pitch clocks, you talk about the analytics, and I'm kind of in the middle ground there. I'm not in the high end of it, or, you know, push it to the side. It's going to change a little again now because you can't do the shift. So my kid that's playing second, his feet have to be on the dirt. You can't be playing, you know, having four outfielders or having a second baseman play just about right field. Pitch clock, the main thing, and that, again, I preached it to two teams. When I leave here again, tomorrow I'm going to talk to Houston. And the main focal point will be, I think it's a focus thing now because you're speeding up and it's going to turn a pitcher into a thrower because all you're going to do is look at the catcher, get the sign real quick, and here we go, I'm heaving it. And you're going to make a lot of mistakes in the strike zone or you're going to throw some pitches without really you know, being behind that pitch mentally and focused on where you want to throw it. So I think it'll make, again, there's a couple pitchers that are wearing the wristband that are calling their own game. Mm-hmm. I called 95% of my game from the mound just with my looks, with my catchers. Had some wonderful catchers. You know, always give them guys props over 24 years. Had some fantastic catchers that paid attention to detail. And if one of those catchers got traded to another team and we were playing them, they knew my cadence and what I was doing with my eyes and which side of the plate I wanted to throw the baseball on. But again, I think the main thing about the pitch clock is that guys are just going to start grabbing a ball, get a sign, mm-hmm. and throw it without understanding how you're trying to break a hitter down.
Do you think – because here's where I'm going with this, Roger. Do you think that this is something that's inevitable, meaning like, listen, you got to evolve. That's just kind of how sports work. Hey, you got to adapt with the times. You know, and it's a good thing. Yeah. You know, the only thing constant is change. Or the other end of the spectrum, sign of the times, you look at Gen Z these days or even younger kids, you know, elementary school and all that, their attention span is so limited, right? You know, if you don't get someone's attention in 3 seconds, 5 seconds, whether it's TikTok or Snapchat, they just can't pay attention. They're not going to sit through a 3.5-hour baseball game where it's a pitcher's duel and it's 1-0 going into the ninth. And they just like, they want it quick. They want it fast. This sort of instant gratification. There's sort of the good, bad, and ugly of this. Yeah. What are your thoughts? And you've got kids in their 20s, 30s, and you said you had grandkids,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the grandboys.
So you've got a good perspective on age and generations.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like you said, but with like football. When I talk to the college football players, coaches, they got to let music blare in the clubhouse now. And they got to have – everybody's got a TV in front of their locker with their swag and their highlights on it. Mm-hmm. You just got to kind of roll with the times a little bit with these guys. You want to speed up baseball, we said get rid of the walk-up music and everything else. But that's
baseball, baby.
Yeah. You got your walk-up music, everybody's styling and popping their collar. And now, you know, I pitched right through it. I mean, the early days, if you hit a bomb and you flipped your bat, do that to Nolan Ryan or Bob Gibson. And see if you're even alive to play the next game.
Straight up.
I mean, that was, you know, I'm jumping around here. My Don Drysdale story was I was 22 years old. I just pitched in Winter Haven. I was with the Red Sox. I pitched my 3 innings against the Dodgers were in town, obviously. And Big Don Drysdale was doing his radio show. I knew the name. I didn't know him. I'd never met him. 6'5". Our PR guy goes, when you get done icing, Don Drysdale's outside by the batting cage. He's like to interview you for a show. So I go out there and meet him. He's a giant of a man. And
I mean, you're not small, Roger.
Yeah,
you're
6'3", 6'4". Yeah, I'm about – he was 6 – you know, he had me by a full inch. And so I go soft-spoken man. We go through 20 minutes his radio show, and he turned his radio off, and then this different voice came out, and it's like – let me tell you something, kid. He goes, I've watched you. You got a chance in this game. I go, thank you, Mr. Drysdale. He goes, you know what my best damn pitch in a game was, kid? Mm-hmm. I go, no, sir, Mr. Drysdale. Now I'm kind of shaking like the Tin Man.
You're calling him Mr. Drysdale, yeah.
Oh,
yes,
yeah,
sir.
Oh, yeah, I'm 20. So I'm kind of I'm kind of got the Tin Man shaking going on looking at the Oz here. And he goes, you know what my best damn pitch in the game was, son? I said, no, sir. He said it was my second knockdown pitch. You know why, kid? He said, because then the hitter knew the first one won an effing mistake. And I was like, yes, sir, Mr. Dry. And I ran out of there. And but that's the old school guys.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I think it's entertainment. You know, we've got the cheerleaders now in the dugouts. You got your walk-up songs. The guys, you know, now I've kind of moved to if you don't like the way things are going, play better. If you don't like the guy flipping his bat, you know, keep the ball out of the middle of the plate, you know, mm-hmm. you're the one that hung it. But, you know, like I said, I agree with a lot of the analytics. I get it, but you still have to have an eye and a heart test. You know, it was great for me, even in my advanced age. I was in my 40s and say with the Yankees, Mel Stoudemire is my pitching coach, and I would come off in the seventh inning. And I was grunting out there, and you could tell that I was laboring a little bit. And he grabbed me, and he's like, you know, Joe, they want to move to the bullpen and because it looks like you're emptying your tank. But Mel and I had a little system that now I go one hitter at a time. So I'm going back out for the eighth knowing that if this guy gets a base hit or gets on, I'm coming out. So my 8 warm-up pitchers are more intense, and now I'm really grinding on it. Now I get him out. The best closer in the game, Mariano Rivera, only has to get 4 outs now. Mm-hmm. Boom, I get a pop-up. Now he's only got, you know. So that's kind of how we operated there instead of just, you know, dragging somebody out of the game right away.
You're in town because one of your sons is playing. He plays for the Phillies?
Yeah, Cody's playing for the Phillies.
Cody's playing for the Phillies. You said you gave a speech, your best Newt Rockne.
Well, yeah, well, the staff, there's about 5 guys on the coaching staff, including the manager, Robbie Thompson, probably the best hitting coach right now in the major leagues, Kay Long. They have a great staff. They have 2 frontline pitchers, the Phillies do. And But Robbie, once they traded for Cody, he called me and said, "We're glad to have Cody. If you're coming down this way, would you mind coming in and visiting with the guys for 20, 30 minutes?" So anytime the guys ask, even though I do, you know, I do a lot of work with the Astros Foundation and stuff with the Astros, if those guys ask me to be a part of it, I'm all in. One of my former team, Red Sox Yankees, if they ask to, you know, there's a few young pitchers that are knocking on the door to the major leagues to visit with them with the group of pitchers or one-on-one, I do it. I mean, I was one of them. And like I said, I think as you saw me light up earlier when I had the opportunity to play with Tom Seaver,
yeah.
I mean, you become a sponge.
Well, I want to talk about this concept of being, I guess, fatherly advice, right? I'm not a father. Pat's a father of four. He'll be right back. But you've kind of mentioned being a dad or even a grandfather these days. Obviously, you know, the easy question would be like, so you played baseball, your kids played baseball. That's, yeah. You know, that's sort of a layup question. But a lot of parents want to give their kids advice these days, especially around coaching. Kids these days, the knock on kids is they're all fat, they're lazy, they're playing video games. So speak to the dads out there, the parents out there that want their kids to participate in sports, right? They don't have the Rocket legacy, right? Yeah. They're not Papa Rocket, but maybe they're athletes or maybe they're not even athletes, but they want to give their kids advice on what to pursue, how to go at it, play multiple sports, pick one.
Yeah.
You know, most of the fathers that are fathers to players these days are probably didn't play in the majors like you. What are those conversations like, and what advice do you have for young fathers out there?
This is a great question. So you got my mind racing. There's just so much information there that I try and pass along. I think before I get into any dad advice or mom advice, I mean, I think it's great that my oldest son teaches right now. He's had an opportunity to go coach in the minor leagues if he wanted to, but he's teaching 7-year-olds to college guys, to the pro guys come over and throw to him. And what's really cool is he's got some single moms that are divorced or the kid's dad had passed away, and he's watched these kids and he's worked with them from 7 to where they're going into high school now, and they've improved so much. And at my foundation, we get wonderful letters about how, you know, thank you for what your son's doing for my kid. I knew nothing about baseball, and mm-hmm. he's helped my kid and got him in a team sport to understand how to work along and be a team player and do something as a group. So I think about that. I think you have to understand where I came from, which people from afar, wherever it might be, that they look at you and they – And it really pisses me off sometimes because, you know, they talk about athletes having a silver spoon or something. Well, I wasn't born with this arm. My pops died when I was 9. I was raised by two strong-willed women, my mother and my grandmother. Hmm. And just like my grandmother grabbed me, she said, if you're going to be a ditch digger, you be the best damn ditch digger in the country.
Yeah.
And that's the way she operated. Of course, she was the same grandma that took a switch and hit me on my hamstrings for throwing her picking her grapes off the grapevine and throwing and throwing them at cars. She later said, once I made it to the major leagues, I knew that boy's going to be good because I knew he had an arm on him. He was throwing those grapes off my grapevine at passing cars all the time. So, you know, I watched my mom work 3 jobs when I was in high school. She was an accountant by day, and I would go with her in warehouse buildings and you know, watch her clean, help her clean. And so I could have a sweet red glove and a badass pair of cleats, you know? Excuse me. So, yeah, you kind of have to start from there. Now, I wanted my boys to grow up differently. And, you know, again, that's why basically after the first couple of years in Major League Baseball, I wanted to make a generational change. And then after I felt like I had my feet, you know, permanently in the ground in the majors, then it was about winning championships again. It's what I learned at the University of Texas. You know, you win, and you know how to win. So when I went to Boston, I felt like I was bringing that winning tradition with me once I got drafted. The dads, I tell them at a 12-year-old game, your 12-year-old's playing third base, and we're sitting in lawn chairs, and even if you were a dad that was a really good high school or college player, don't forget how fast – that ball gets – it looks super slow to us. We're sitting there, and we could field that ball, but it gets on that 12-year-old very, very fast. He's trying to process that. So it's just it's a different game. Our game looks great when you're sitting in the third, fourth row. I would encourage you to come stand in the batter's box and just watch when I throw you a – you know, 95, 98 mile an hour fastball. This isn't your local batter ball where you go put the quarter in the machine and throws you 10 balls down the middle. It's just a whole different deal. I mean, I can't tell you. I threw a ball in one time. A scout told me I threw a ball in 97. A guy squared it up. It hit me in the shin at 132. I wanted to cry. It hurt. Yeah, I wanted to cry. It hurt so bad. I mean, my molars hurt. They came out to the mound. What was even worse, to add to the, just to put a little salt in the wound, as they say, the ball ricocheted off my shin into the home side dugout. We were on the road. And time I got collected and they wrapped my big old – I had a big old knot swelling up on my leg. I looked over, the guy standing on second. I said, what the hell is – what's he doing? They go, it's a ground rule double. It hit you it hit you and bounced to the dug. Guy gets second base. I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, thanks so, a lot.
Yeah, thanks.
One
yeah.
leg. Take
so,
second.
Yeah, so, yeah. So, but, yeah, I try and tell the parents, even if they're playing football, baseball, basketball, whatever – and instead of hollering out so many commands when you're on the mm-hmm. field, or if there's something they did, make a little mental note, and then on the way home, maybe turn the radio off in the car and have a good little visit about him. Always tell the kids, take zero talent to hustle. That you have no talent. We have a children's wing at home in Houston. There's a couple kids down there with the missing a hand and a leg. They would love nothing more to stand in the batter's box, take a full swing, and hit a comebacker to the pitcher and fly down first base, chalk coming off their you know, cleats flying, and they'll never get the opportunity to do that.
Perspective, gratitude.
So that's it. So, you know, it takes zero talent to hustle. I have no problem from a 8-year-old to one of my big league guys making a physical mistake. I love them laying out, trying to lay out for a ball, whatever that might be. Obviously not forgetting how many outs there are or what you're supposed to do there. So, I think, you know, sports is a great outlet. I mean, I like that, but I also like the business side of everything too. We look at that a lot. My boys are, you know, definitely into that. You know, they get to be their own guy, and again, I think the biggest compliment I get, it's kind of oxymoron, but if you didn't know they were my boys, you wouldn't know it. They usually introduce themselves, looking at you in the eye, handshake, and say their first name, and so. I mean, that's the way I look at with the dads, too. I mean, I tell people, they say, oh, pressure and pressure and pressure this and pressure that. Pitching in game sevens of the World Series, been in 6 World Series, and 2 of the losses were the most emotional. But they talk about pressure. I tell people, I say, you want to know what pressure is? I say, come home with me, and one of the boys are 6, 7 years old, and you're doing dad's pitch. You get 6 pitches. And I'm trying like hell to hit that kid's bat. and 5 pitches later, I haven't hit his bat, and one of the moms are up in the stand screaming, at, Jesus Christ, throw my kid a strike. You're a professional.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I got to throw. You know, I said, that's pressure. I mean, you got
to. You know, literally did that. So you would go to
little,
and then you would be pitching to kids.
So like Cody, I got pictures of Cody when he was standing next to me in the dad circle. You know, you throw the ball, if the kid hits you, you got to run off the field as the dad, and they go crazy. And so I get done pitching to our guys, and I'm walking off. The opposing coach comes, said, Rocket, my kids, everybody know, will you throw to our team too? I'm like, oh, my gosh.
How old are the kids, by the way?
Probably 6, 7.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're just beating that little kid right
yeah,
in the
you're
chest.
Yeah, you're not supposed to have 12
punch outs. Toughen up, kid.
You're not supposed to have 12 punch outs in dad's pitch. You know what I'm saying? I'm not supposed to strike out 12 guys
yeah, exactly.
in dad's pitch. I'm trying to hit their
ass. Hey, competitive nature is going to take over at some point. Sorry, kid.
So, I mean, that's, you know, and your question is spot on. There'll be, you know, this offseason or whatever, we'll go to a couple of these games with the grand boys, and I'll have to call a couple dads or a coach over and go, guys,
yeah,
my boys and I and even me, I said, do you remember any trophies that you won up to 12 years old? No. I said, let's keep your boys healthy, because I do a thing with Dr. James Andrews, the Andrews Institute, Pensacola. We developed a shoulder program for pitchers. And the
most famous surgeon, yeah, of course.
He said he's done more Tommy Johns on 15-year-olds.
On 15-year-olds?
15-year-old boys. Yeah, he's encouraging them to play other sports. Set the ball down, maybe play another sport. And but I preach to the high school guys. You know, I'll go there and watch him throw, and the trainer comes over, and the guy pitches like 4 any high school guys, a junior, senior in high school, and they'll put the ice on the kid's elbow with the wrap, and they'll wrap it. And the next thing you know, he's sitting in the dugout for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And you got a nerve in there. You don't want to ice. You know, if you're a lot of guys don't ice anymore. We did it all the time, and ice agrees with me. I got an ice tank. There's no way I would have pitched until I was 45 years old without my body agreeing to ice. So
I think this advice, so Pat's got four kids, two boys, they're playing sports. You know, I was, I played college football, I was a basketball player as well. I had a little game, but I had the most contentious relationship with my father ever. Okay. You got, like, you talk about the dad that's on the sidelines yelling, screaming, hollering. It's just A, it doesn't help. B, it's embarrassing, right?
Yeah.
And C, it's like, what are we doing here? We're in front of everybody. It's just not a good look for the family. And I feel like a lot of fathers don't know how to handle, you know, they're watching their son in the game, right? Mothers are always going to be cheering and, you know, protective of their kid. But the, because more than anything, you bond with your kids. As a father and son, sports, wrestling, you wrestle with your kids all the time. It's different with a mother. Mother, you're hugging, it's kissing, it's more affectionate. But for you to be the guy that's like, no, take it down a notch. Like, how do you operate when you're in the stands? Even when they were younger, were you hooting and hollering and yelling? Were you just kind of quiet and stoic?
Yeah, I mean,
how do you handle it?
Everybody else is doing the cheering. I kind of get stoic. I'm watching how they're breaking, you know. The boys always say, Dad, you know, I hit the home run. They showed you on the over the, you know, in the seats, and you weren't even class. I said, because I was kind of locked. I'm trying to watch this pitcher, how he's breaking you down. I'm really focusing on the catcher because I know he's calling the game against you. So I'm looking for patterns, you know. But, you know, you clap and react. And then there's some other times where I'm amazed that this guy even pitched to you in this situation. I mean, Cody, when he was at Texas his last year, he put the team on his back and carried the team. Mm. And again, I think I could take either one of you two with me to that clubhouse, and you guys could cover the analytics part, the sports part a little bit, because like you said, you played, and Pat, same thing with, you know, with the kids and what he's doing here, and then even cover, as what I think is most important, even with some of these guys, the business part of it and what happens off the field, which is even more important to me when they come through that door, that they have their family stuff in order. We all have the same, I would say, I don't want to call them problems, issues. It doesn't matter how much money you make.
Right.
You still could have a girlfriend issue coming in the ballpark when you got a, you're on the mound in a massive, a must-win game for us. And you got to, as soon as you get out of your car in a player's parking lot, you got to turn that off. Because now it's your second family, and this is what makes the world go round. So I can't tell you how many players that I wasn't a babysitter for him, but I would just be like reaffirm. No, that's not a big deal right now. Just focus here. Get focused on what you need to do here, because once this game starts, stuff's going to be happening fast. And then I need to hear you tell me that the game is slowed down. That tells me that you've been practicing perfect. You're doing quality work. We don't need quantity. You do quality work. Now, if you're having trouble with your breaking ball, your release point, got a pitcher, my pitching coaches are my eyes. I said, here's what you, whether it been a rookie pitching coach or a veteran, here's my three hot points. I want to feel tall. You know, I want to keep my chin down. I don't want to drift, and I want to stay back, because in a big game, you're trying to hurry. Just like a golfer. Golfer swings, you're trying to get up front, you're hitting a slice. So there's just a handful, I don't even say a handful, maybe three or four hot points, whether you're a control guy, 86, a Greg Maddux, pinpoint control too, a
power, ridiculous power, control
power, make that ball move like you read about,
and
myself and Greg and I just did a thing for the Golf Channel. We both said, even though we throw almost 10 miles an hour difference, mm-hmm. we both pitched off our fastball, and we both you know, he made a great point, a big compliment, when they went to interleague play. He pulled up my starts because he knew I pitched off my fastball and I used both sides of the plate and blah blah blah.
Here's the questions I got. The game. So Anthony Edwards, the other day, is in the All-Star game, and I don't know if you know who Anthony Edwards is. Stud of a guy in the NBA. The guy's a rock star. I think he plays for the Timberwolves.
Yeah,
he's a fireball. I mean, he's just an exciting guy to watch. And he says, so what do you think about what's going on with the product of the NBA? And he says, you know, if there's one thing I could change with the NBA is I wish – superstars would play every day and they wouldn't take these 2-3 days off, right? And then I saw Barkley yesterday. He's being interviewed by Stephen A. Smith. Not yesterday, probably 2 days ago or 3 days ago. And Stephen A. Smith's talking to him about the future of the NBA, the product, all this stuff. He says, Barkley said, the NBA is about to come up for re-signing their new TV deal. You know, whatever the TV deal they got to get. NFL gets great TV deals, but he's saying, hey, this new TV deal they do, the company is going to be asking and saying, why the hell are we doing TV deals? People are not watching season NBA games because players are taking 2-3 days off and they don't want to work. So to me, the product of the NBA season has become shitty. That's my opinion. And I'm a guy that loves the NBA. I don't even watch season anymore because it's fake to me. We got 7 guys averaging 30 points a game. Annoying. This ain't no real basketball. If you're, you know, the other day, All-Star game, the worst All-Star game of all time. Sacramento Kings were playing the Clippers the other day. The winner won 176 to 175. That doesn't even make any sense to have a score like that, right? So I think that's hurting the NBA product. Do you think AI and predictive analytics is taking the emotion, fun, complete game, that pride, the shutout concept out of MLB? Do you think AI is kind of getting people to say, well, we're going to have 3 different pitchers today. You're going to pitch 3 innings. You're going to pitch 3 innings. You're going to... So, but that's kind of cool to get that. But, dude, I don't like that as a fan. So you think these guys are no longer thinking about what fills up the seats and what gets people to watch season baseball? Is that a concern of yours?
I think you're dead on, Pat. Listen, let's start with the NBA. So you got to understand, when I came up with the Red Sox across the street, I got to go over and watch Larry Bird. Mm-hmm. And I got to watch McHale and Danny Ainge. And yeah, some
Parrish.
Straight, you're talking about your Parrish. You know, I mean, straight trash talkers, right? Mm-hmm. And Red's there doing his thing and on parquet floor. So I was lucky, you know. I actually did a little BS show. I think it was called The Rocket Report. I interviewed Michael Jordan, and I was just with Michael not too long ago at his course, and I just smile and laugh about it that we were so young. And but what I'm saying is, you're exactly right. It seems like in the NBA, I mean, if you give an NBA player 2 feet, you know, I'm guarding you from 2 feet, you're making that shot every time. And I've heard the stories too. They go down and you got your 32. Yeah, I got my 28. Let's play defense the last 5 minutes, see who wins. But the scores are that's why the scores are well over 100 and doing things. There's just, I mean, other than the playoffs, like in baseball, I preached, it's great that you guys can slug, but when you get to the playoffs, pitching and defense is going to win for you. It's no difference having a great defense in the NFL. But if I'm giving you this distance from where we sit right here, Pat, I mean, you're scoring. You're gonna score 50, and so again, I don't watch a lot of the NBA. I watch when I know my friends in the NBA are playing. I watch them because we have the same conversation, you know, about what's going on. I have the same conversation with my 30 PGA buddies, is, you know, and some of them are bitching and moaning that I'm not in the top 30, and they're pissed off. I said, well, you play better. And we talked about early, mm-hmm. you know, do something about that and play better is what you got to do. So the changes in Major League Baseball, you hit it dead on. There's a bunch of old school coaches in these camps, and I'm going to experience it tomorrow. And I'll see some of them. And they tell me, you know, like I said, when I was on the mound the seventh inning and here comes the pitching coach or the manager, I got the ball tucked under my armpit. And when he gets them out, I said, what the hell are you doing out here? Get your ass back in the dugout. I'm going to finish this game, or I'm going to eat as many outs right now as I can. We talked about it earlier. And there's only 3 or 4, maybe a Scherzer. There's a few. Verlander, he'll stretch it out now that he's got a new elbow. He's been stretching it out and doing his thing. And but there's a handful of those guys, but you're right. I won't mention the name, but I was in a locker room during the game talking to actually a couple of the analytic guys. The pitcher that pitched that came out after 5 innings, he was done. He was winning the game 3-1. He saw me, you knew I was there to watch too, and he came in like he was exhausted after 5 innings, rips his jersey off and kind of throws it in the laundry basket on the floor. And I was talking. I said, hold on a minute, guys. I go, what are you doing? Oh, I'm done, Mr. Clemens. I'm done. I said, yeah, you went 5 innings. I said, pick that shit up. There's no way it's dirty and hang it back in your locker. There's no way
that
dirty.
I love that.
Yeah.
I said, pick that
shit up.
Yeah.
And he started to. I go, no, I'm just kidding. I wasn't. But I said, no, I'm just messing with you. So, but Yeah, so I mean, they're doing some things where they call them openers. You know, they're bringing in the long man first, and then they're going that way too. So I get that you protect. They protect. They watch me early in my 20s. Still at about 115, 120 pitches. When I got in my 40s, they kept an eye on me in August because we were going to the playoffs, so they wanted me fresh in October. A lot of times, if I was the game one or game seven, I was always game three swing because that's a big momentum. You go down two. A lot of times I was pitching where we were down 0-2, and I couldn't have a hiccup when I went out there. This was, you know, a must-win is a must-win. One of the biggest ones was game three in 2001 when President Bush came out throughout the first pitch, threw a perfect strike. And he actually came in with his bulletproof vest in New York. We're playing the Arizona Diamondbacks, and we're down 2-0. And Mr. Steinbrenner had brought back all the police officers and firefighters and people that lost their loved ones. It was probably one of the most emotional games I had to pitch because when I busted out of the locker room in Old Yankee Stadium, I turned right and go about 20 yards to go to the weight room to do my cuff work and get loose. I don't like running in front of the fans and stuff. I'll get on a treadmill and get on my pre, so when I go out there, I'm hot, and here we go. And I busted out of the clubhouse door, and, like, I had some men and women, some firemen just hugging me. And man, I was like,
this is a month after 9/11, not even, right?
So I was supposed to pitch this. So, and I'll tell you guys this while I'm on the topic and I'm thinking about it. I played 24 years. I tell people I consider myself a great team player. It pales to the trip that I did. So I was supposed to pitch 9/11. I was a New York Yankee going against my former team, the Red Sox. So everybody and their mother were in town. I was going for my 20th win. I usually try and sleep to about 8:30 on game day. We get in about 1 after night game, whatever, from the Yankee Stadium. My buddy was only two floors. We got an overlook floor that upstairs I put turf in that you can kind of look out the city real pretty, 8 miles, 9 miles from World Trade. Banging my door down about 8:05. And I'm like, man, what's up? Something happened to World Trade. So out our bay window up there on the 25th floor, I always see four-seat airplanes going down the Hudson. So I thought it was a mishap with one of the planes that go down tour of the Statue of Liberty. He goes, no, it's bigger than that. So we run up. We could hear and feel the second plane. Go back down, turn on the tube, see all hell's breaking loose. Doorman's at my place, says, you guys need to, they're going to shut down bridges. You need to get out of here. So we went to my buddy's place. We loaded everybody up. My wife was there, had a bunch of girlfriends there. We had other friends we called. People were all in town to watch my 20th. And we busted out of there. Fast forward. We all know what happened, in our lives and how our world changed. General Myers, our four-star general at the time, went to high school with my agents. He called and said, would Rocket go to the Middle East to see our men and women? I said, we called Drew Carey, the comedian. Drew went with us, told some jokes. 7 days, a booklet about the size of my iPhone cover, military time. We lost one person when we were over there. It's really the only time I saw General Myers get upset. They dressed him down until the media knew that we went into Afghanistan to a base they just bombed. But anyway, I met, you know, again, so if anybody – I had five uncles that served. I lost my oldest brother. He served in Vietnam. And so anytime, just like I led off with this speech in front of the guys because the Phillies actually have one or two guys that had served. And now they're trying to pick up their baseball career. I mean, back in the day, Ted Williams and all these guys.
It was a normal thing back then, but.
Yeah.
World War II, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, it was an unbelievable trip. I saw, people that, again, make me feel comfortable on center stage in front of 55,000 people to be able to do my job. That night that President Bush threw out that first pitch, I was in the bullpen with Mel Stoudemire, my pitching coach. We turned around, we're the silhouettes. You could see about 14, 15 sharpshooters on top of the stadium. Damn. And it was just – and it lit up like a Christmas tree. He threw a beautiful strike. The two stories you guys probably – you may have heard them already. I'll tell you the two funny things. I'll regress here in a minute. But I knew we were really close with 41. I knew 43, but not as well as I did. We even called him Gampy. That's why he called the grandkids Gampy. Anytime I went to Kenny Bunkport, we got to throw horseshoes. I got a damn horseshoe pit in my house because of him. He sent over a 30-page fax on how to mix the clay with the sand. I mean, he's serious about his
HW.
Yeah, he's serious. 43, he's got the bulletproof vest under his deal. He wants to throw. I said, Mr. President, you're going to have to go out the door, go to the right about 100 yards. It's, you know, old Yankee Stadium. You know, we got ghosts running around in that place, right? And the batting cage is all the way down there. I said, Posada and Jeter and some of the guys probably down there doing their tee work or whatever doing to get ready, so you'll see them. He says, great. So he goes down there and throws 5 or 10 warm-up pitches, realizes he can do it. And then I wasn't there. This is the word I got, and I think it was on a documentary. But he, on his way out the door with all the Secret Service, he stops. He sees Derek, shakes his hand. He says, Derek, he goes, any pointers? And Derek goes, well, Mr. President, yeah, you can't throw from the grass, not the dirt. You got to get up, you know, where rock is at on the rubber, and you got to let it fly from there. Mm-hmm. Oh, hell, I can handle that. No problem. I can do that. And then he says, anything else? He goes, yeah. He goes, this is New York, Mr. President, and if you bounce it, they will boo you. And so he goes, oh, now I'm nervous.
Yeah.
So he told that one. I'll go back to my trip to the Middle East. This is what they all – now, again, I'm 6'4". They had two Marines as my bodyguards, and they're both 6'6". I look like a – no offense to punters, and NFL, but I look like a punter standing next to these guys. And so they had me covered. They said, when you jump in the crowd and you're signing for all our military guys, I'm going to whisper in your ear, you got 2 minutes to get to the chase vehicle. You got to get to the chase vehicle. No problem. And they both, so when I got to, we actually flew over on Air Force 2. Then when we got to Shannon, Ireland, we jumped on. They put me on a C-17 transport plane with 25 of the baddest ass Marines you've ever seen in your life. And these guys were getting on me because I had a second suitcase. I was like one of, you know, a chick. You know, I brought, you know, my clothes, and I had a second
suitcase. Pack light, buddy.
Pack light. No, they're on me. So I told them, I'm pretty finicky about what I eat. Plus, I got to be careful with seafood. You know, with the iodine in it, man, I look like Rocky Balboa within a, you know, cut me Mick. And but in this second suitcase, I had nothing but oatmeal, Cliff Bar. I had a powder and granola and everything, because the two times I pitched for Team USA, jumping here getting long-winded on y'all, but playing for Team USA, you know, I went over there and a couple guys got food poisoning. We had to send them back, and I found like a Chef Boyardee for 2 weeks. I found like a Chef Boyardee a spaghetti and a Diet Coke, and I lived off that for 7 days, 8 days over there during that USA game. So I was being careful. I'm not going to go over and get sick. And so I got this all this stuff, and they were bitching and moaning me about it. But I was teasing my agent before I went. I said, hey, I'm taking this extra suitcase full of stuff because I'm not going to get over there and, you know, eat a camel or something. Just mess with me. Funny, isn't it? Funny. So day six, we're at this Prince's thing in Kuwait City. They cook 2 lambs in the ground. They bring them out. Now, I sat at a table with some of the guys I've gotten to know. I didn't want to sit at the head table with all their, you know, all their people and everything that was going on. But General Myers is up there and everybody else, and they go, you're up here. You're sitting front and center with us.
Roger Clemens, head of the table.
So I'm looking. They got an interpreter and everything, and they set the first plate. And there's a pita bread, white rice, and I got a diet 7-Up. And I'm saying, okay, this is it. It's going to be my meal. Out of nowhere, don't you know, they drop a baby camel, right? Hump,
get out of
teeth,
here.
Everything right here. And I'm like, you guys are messing. Now I'm getting punked.
Yeah.
I said, no, you guys are messing with me now. And I said, I'm not getting that. Well, my agent had the guy. They cut into it, and we're not eating. The first cut into it by the hump, okay, it looked like Bernays was coming out of it. All right? I'm like, you got to be kidding. And they dug around with these big tongs, and then boom, next thing you know, he pulled out some meat that looked like shredded pork. And he puts a softball size on my plate, and everybody's looking at me. And these guys are like, they're all, and Drew Carey's looking, and I'm like, and I pushed that around my plate for like an hour. I mean, I didn't care if we started a world war or something, you know. I'm, you know, so, And then Drew's girlfriend at the time, she was dipping into my stuff, and I was like, yeah, y'all are bitching, you know, getting on my ass for bringing this, and
now you want my oatmeal.
Yeah, now you want my oatmeal. So anyway, that's my. But anyway, if anybody out there and you guys know, if you served or anybody has served, I friggin' tip my hat to you and say thank you. It doesn't go unnoticed. We do a Helping a Hero deal where. We're building 100 homes for our military men and women that served for us and gave the ultimate sacrifice. And we got Johnny Morris from Bass Pro. He's playing a big role in this for us. So again, I thank you guys.
Now, what a great story. By the way, I watched that thing on. I'm sure you saw Jeter's Captain documentary. I thought it was really good. Yeah. And you know, there was a whole section with you in it.
Oh, yeah.
The whole 9/11, yeah. George Bush. That was interesting to watch that. Obviously, you forget sports. If you're a fan of the sports, like we are, you know, you look at it from our lens. Your lens is different than our lens. We're watching you. But when you saw that, you're like, I totally forgot. Can you show the first pitch when he threw President Bush's first pitch right there? Yeah, take a look at this.
An absolute perfect strike. He's got a bulletproof vest on underneath this jacket.
Let the audio. Let's hear the audio.
Look at that. How great was that? How great was that? I'm out in the bullpen right there and watching it. That stadium lit up like a Christmas tree. Mr.
President. By the way, that's one of the greatest first pitches a celebrity is throwing at a game with all the pressure like that.
100%.
Because the complete opposite is the one that I just sent you. Can you play the other one that shows the top 10 worst? Tell me which one of these is bad on your list. Go ahead and play. Let's hear the audio.
I think one of the girls was a gymnast and did like a cartwheel or something.
Did you see that? So this is. This is who, Carl Lewis?
Yeah,
I can't see who it is.
Yeah.
Let's see how Carl Lewis
watch
does.
Watch this.
Stick to running, but how does that happen? You're the greatest athlete.
Who else?
Oh, this is a good one here. I know what's happening here.
Oh, beautiful pitch.
He threw him out.
This is going to end.
MJ?
MJ, yeah.
No, MJ. At the Cubbies?
By the way, you would have thought Michael would have thrown like a perfect, you know, because he played baseball.
Well, it was aggressive, you know, so that's better than throwing a grounder. Come on, Barack.
Yeah, here we go. All of a sudden, it's showtime. Oh, lefty, that's right.
Jeez. All right. Did you catch it?
Yeah.
All right. At least caught it.
This is the one. This is Nolan Ryan. Most strikeouts. Look what he threw.
This still might have been 85 miles an hour. And when he was 60, what is it?
Nolan.
Oh, man.
Just a bit outside.
You didn't see that one?
No, that's a normal pitch for Nolan. He pitched inside a lot.
You're just brushing him off.
He knew exactly where he's going with that. There's a first pitch somewhere that absolutely wears out.
Baba Booey?
Yeah.
50 Cent.
Oh, 50.
They don't want this album to come out.
Oh, man.
That's a splitter right there.
You found some that I've not seen before.
John Wall.
Oh, my goodness.
John. Who was that? That was John Wall.
Yeah, it looks easy.
The point guard.
Oh, here you go.
This is the one.
That's just great embarrassing.
Great
form. Just embarrassing. Can you go back to George W. Bush's, by the way? By the way, this moment right here, this was... You know, I'm all about presidential approval ratings. This was the highest presidential approval ratings I think we've had in that moment right there in, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 years. You know, right now we're sort of hovering. You're lucky these days if you get to 50%, whether it's Biden, whether it's Trump.
Yeah.
Even Obama was struggling to get to 50. He was at 80% at this time.
It's pretty wild to think about, 80%. We had him at an event. I had him at the same event that we had the late Kobe Bryant at. And when I announced, hey, and the speakers at this event will be President George Bush, silent, because some people were not wanting to see him. Some people were very happy, but it was 50-50. I said, Kobe, everybody flipped out. They lost their minds. So Kobe, President Bush comes. We do the event. There's 6,000 people there, 6,200. And we have a great conversation in the back. And then afterwards, he's doing photo op with 100 people that qualify to do the pictures. And I'm standing there the entire time because I just want to hear what people are going to say. And people would say things like, let me tell you, I saw you as this. And when you were president, I thought you were this and I thought you were that. But the message you gave today, because he just opened up. He says, let me tell you what I did. I used to do this. I had a bad habit of doing this. I had a bad habit of doing this. The way he spoke that day, everybody fell in love with the guy that day, the way he spoke, President Bush. So it's interesting that you're saying how one day they love you, next day they hate you, next day they miss you, the next day they hate you. You have to be patient, because if you're loved today, take your time. Someone's going to hate you in about a couple months. Yeah. And if they hate you today, be patient. Trust me, there's love around the corner as well. This whole concept about how you deal with love-hate relationship, how did you handle that as a player? Because that's got to be something you experienced
a lot. Well, I played with two of the most historic teams. You know, I consider myself really lucky, you know, being drafted by the Red Sox out of the University of Texas, you know. So, I mean, the Rangers and the Astros were following me so close at Texas. You know, I got to go back to when I was in high school. I was the third best pitcher on the team. I had two. I took classes early so I could graduate at 17. But when there were two other guys, a righty and lefty, back in the 80s that threw over 90 miles an hour, which was, you know, rare, the scouts were coming to watch him. Now, we got in the playoffs a couple times. I was a better defensive end than I was probably a pitcher first baseman. And
really?
Yeah, I was 6'2". I was still, you know, baby fat. You know, I was young.
Roger, your hands are massive hands.
Yeah. I got my granddaddy's. Holy I got my freaking, granddaddy's those hands balls. Are, yeah.
Is that a benefit for a pitcher?
For that split finger, it is.
Hell yeah, it is.
Yeah. So,
look at the size of that ring, by
Yeah, that's our national. I wear my national championship ring more than I do.
Why is that? Why?
Just because.
More pride?
It really happened for me at the university. You know, jumping around. I had three wonderful coaches coming up. You know, I lost my pops. My high school coach, great, great coach, better teacher of the game and life lessons. Then I go and I get to play for Wayne Graham, one of the winningest coaches in college baseball. Turned the University of Rice program around. Great coach, better teacher of the game, baseball lifer. And he watched me grow and mature that year. Pop over to Texas, play for the winningest coach at that time. Cliff Gustafson, and Gus, the same thing. Great coach, better man and teacher of what we are doing, life lessons. My boys go to University of Texas. They play for their winningest coach in baseball, Augie Garrido, who since passed. Augie gave them some great life lessons. So, again, that's where I came from. I was the third best pitcher. I tell the kids, nobody, but I threw strikes, and I had a little Bugs Bunny curveball. So when those older guys, everybody came to see him, they didn't wet the bed, they shit the bed. Coach would bring me in the game because I threw strikes. Coach always said after, you know, I got, I made it a couple years in the big leagues, he said, you know, that kid, I could bring him in, turn the lights out in the stadium, he could throw strikes. So then when I got to Texas, there was no baseball lifting stuff. We lifted with the football guys. So my legs got stronger, grew 2 inches. Fastball started jumping. Next thing you know, I mean, the same reason why I went to Texas on scholarship. Mom didn't have the money, so I was paving my way, and she wanted me to stay in school. When I got drafted after my freshman year, the scout said, you know, if he didn't sign right now, he'd probably never get another chance. My mom basically told him, and I was in my room crying for 2 days. She kicked the scout out of the house and said, he's going to school. I want him to get his education. So that's kind of how that's kind of how my path, you know, took place. And then Boston drafted me. I was like, Boston? Well, I didn't even know. I wasn't sure where Boston was, you know. And but my mom, the history, we love history, and she wrote me a poem about Fenway Park. And then when I got to Fenway, you know, the Green Monster. The best was when they called me up. I don't think cell phones are there. This was 83, and I was watching a game. I think Dennis Eckersley and Palmer were pitching, but they bring me in. I get in the cab at the airport, and I've got my face in a paper, and the guy stops, cabbie stops, and I see this brick building, and the cabbie goes, here you go, kid. I go, cabbie, I'm a professional ball player. I'm going to Fenway Park. I said, this looks like a warehouse. Because I see the brick only, you know. And he goes, this is Fenway Park, kid. Get your ass out of my cab. Yeah. And I get out, and the team meets me, and they bring me up the tunnel right, you know, on first base side where you see the Green Monster. And then to go, you know, there and jump forward to playing as long as I did, both the two older boys, and Devin and I had a little 10-year break, and then the other boys are in their 20s now. they were able to see me play long enough when the boys make a comment, it's like, Pops, and, you know, you pitched right where Luke Garrett gave his farewell speech.
Mm.
Or, you know, I played in the Bob Hope tournament 20 years. I had Yogi Berra as my partner a couple of times, you know, having Yogi. I mean, the guy's got – he's got 10 rings.
Was he funny as hell?
Oh, he played it up. I told him – I said, hey, about third or fourth hole, all this media following, so I want to get an 8x10 of you and I. I'm gonna line my putt up. I want you leaning over like you're reading it for me. But we were doing it seriously. It was funky, and I kind of knew which way it was going to break, but I hear we staged this photo, and people are everywhere, and I go, Yogi, what do you think? Which way? You know, which way is this ball going? He goes, better you than me, kid, and he walked off. And I always told Yogi that the two catchers I wish I would have thrown to were Yogi and Johnny Bench. And Yogi goes, why me? I said, because I see all the old photos of you, Yogi, and you never could squat down. You know, I would get the high strike for sure because you could never squat.